We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today, we're back with one of my favorite guests, one of my favorite academics, Brad Wilcox. He's the director of the National Marriage Project at the University of Virginia. He's also a senior fellow for the Institute for Family Studies and a Deseret News contributor. Brad, welcome back.
It's great to be here, Emily.
You're out with more important research. You're always out with important research, and research nobody else seems to exactly be targeting in quite the way that you do. And this time, your research is timed with Father's Day. It's a really interesting look at the importance of fathers and the consequences for children's lives when they're without their fathers. So, Brad, can you just give us a basic summary of what this new report looks at?
Yeah, Emily, what we're seeing, I think, you know, in looking at young men across this country is that too many of our young men are floundering, failing. You know, they're acting up, they're acting out, they're not doing well in school. They are obviously getting in trouble with the law. We've had some really horrible, you know, examples recently on that score. And what we're doing with this particular new report is talking about how all this intersects with the growing share of young men in our country have been raised in a home without their biological father. And just underlining that, you know, such young men are much more likely to be having trouble navigating the transition into adolescence and adulthood. And we look at that specifically by looking at college graduation, by looking at idleness for guys in their mid-20s, and by looking at arrests and incarcerations for young men as well. So those are kind of our sets of outcomes in this new report, Emily.
Yeah. And I mean, the idleness question is one of the hardest ones to fully understand because it's so I imagine as a researcher, it's one of the hardest ones to pin down. And Nick Eberstadt has done some excellent work trying to, I guess, flesh out the contours of what idleness looks like. But what are we learning and what's in the report about that problem specifically?
Yeah. So what we did is we looked at this in a kind of different ways, kind of before we finalized our report here. I mean, we looked at, you know, the number of young men in their mid-20s who are not employed full time. I mean, we're talking about a very large minority of young men, like, you know, more than 30%. But we kind of just what we did is for this final report is we just focused on young men who are not working and not in school. And when we look at that particular pattern, what we see is that 19% of young men who grew up without their father are idle by that definition, and they're not in school or not working at all, compared to just 11% of young men who have a biological father present when they were growing up. So the bottom line here is that not having your biological dad in the picture in the household, you know, increased your risk of being idle in this way by about 70% for guys in their mid-20s in the U.S. Today. So there's a clear connection here between not having a father in the picture and having more difficulty navigating, you know, work and school in your 20s.
Has that cohort grown? And I don't know if we have COVID numbers yet, but has it grown post-COVID? Well, was it growing pre-COVID?
I think that the COVID thing is a whole wrench in the train. We'll have to sort of figure that out, you know, in the next year or two. Because it obviously with unemployment benefits and people being fired from jobs and, you know, new businesses starting up in the midst of, you know, COVID, you know, but leading into COVID, we had seen an increase in the number of 20-something guys who were not employed. And then Nick Eberstadt, who you mentioned before, has pointed out that, you know, in 2019, just before COVID hits, there are about 7 million men in prime ages, 25, 54, who were not working. So a large minority of folks, particularly guys who don't have college degrees, are much more likely to be falling in this category of having no connection to labor force. But when you kind of raise the bar just to full-time work, you see an even sort of larger group of guys who are not working full-time. And that's especially high among, you know, 20-somethings today. So that's cause for concern for us.
The incarceration figures are pretty striking. I'm looking at your research brief right now. You have a subheading, Father Present Families Keep Their Sons Out of Jail. And just looking at these numbers, the percentage of people who have ever been arrested, men who have ever been arrested ages 15 to 19, it's a 10% difference between whether they had their father present or not, 21% to 31% if you did not grow up with your father present. And by the ages of 28 to 34, you see a similar 10% gap, 10 to 21%. Does this track what you've seen over time? I imagine it does.
Yeah, no, it does. I mean, and the incarceration trends are especially striking. What this basically showing is that young men who are growing up without their biological father and also are about twice as likely, almost twice as likely to end up in jail or in prison, you know, by about age 30. So this is a big, you know, association. And I did some other work on incarceration trends at the community level with some colleagues recently. We found that it was family structure in the neighborhood level was one of the most important predictors of whether or not, you know, high rates of young men from communities were landing in jail at some point. So there is a big connection here. We don't often talk about it in the culture. There was just a big New York Times story today on crime and how some neighborhoods are riddled with criminal violence. And they talked about poverty and they talked about, you know, neighborhood disadvantage. They talked about, you know, a bunch of things in that New York Times article. But the one word that was missing was family or father. So there's just kind of an allergy in the part of a lot of these mainstream outlets to, you know, grapple with the sort of way in which young men who are not well fathered are much more likely to have trouble with the law.
We've talked about this before, Brad, especially as it relates to motherhood and single motherhood in particular, but that allergy from legacy media outlets, do you think it comes from a general desire not to be wedded, so to speak, to the nuclear family or maybe that traditional structure? There's this idea that maybe there's something fashionable or in vogue about questioning that structure. And so anything that is sort of in the traditional narrative, I guess you would be allergic to, including and folding into this context.
Yeah, there's what I call a devotion to the family diversity theory. This is the idea that what matters for kids is not the structure of their homes, but just love and money. And what kids need is love and money. And they can get love in any number of different family forms, so long as their parents or their parent has enough money. And that's, of course, where the government can step in too with, you know, a child tax credit or with other forms of support, you know, in terms of Medicaid and government health care. So, and I think this year is a lot of purchase on the left. I think there's also, this is also partly about kind of an allegiance to this idea that we're kind of progress requires moving beyond, you know, antiquarian ideas about the family, and that we're progressives, we're always kind of embracing the new thing. And that relates to sort of the latest family form. You know, and there's also a real commitment to a profound individualism, you know, when it comes to family life, that, you know, people should be free to do whatever they want to do when it comes to having kids, raising kids, marriage, relationships, and a reluctance to assert any kind of binding, you know, and authoritative standard about how people should live their lives in the family. Now, of course, the irony here is that number one, there's no hesitation to assert binding expectations when it comes to something like, you know, the vaccines, obviously. And then also, and I think more importantly, we have a huge problem with a lot of our elites talking left and walking right. So we did a survey in California and found that a majority of college-educated Californians believed in the sort of family diversity theory. All family forms are basically, you know, equal, should be celebrated. But then we asked them, what's your own kind of approach, your own plan? And a large share of them said they wanted to have their kids in marriage. And a clear majority of them were stably married with kids if they were parents. You know, our California elites even, you know, talk left but walk right. And we actually found in the heart of Hollywood, one of the neighborhoods just above where they had the Oscars has extremely low level of single parenthood, you know, in that neighborhood, looking at census data. So again, you know, showrunners, producers, other figures in Hollywood, you know, who may be, you know, producing films, rock videos, you know, TV shows that, you know, basically valorize any number of departures from the traditional family, actually in the real world often benefit from a traditional family for themselves and for their kids. So that's an irony. It's a problem, of course, because they're sending a message out to ordinary folks that is not consistent with that approach.
Brad, you're coming out strong in favor of Dan Quayle.
Yeah, Dan Quayle was right. And that was, for us, the cover story that was written, of all places, in The Atlantic, you know, many, many, many moons ago by Barbara Duffel Whitehead, who's a great, you know, family historian. So, but yeah, that's she was right then, and you're right now.
Well, I love the survey that you did, because you looked at zip code, and you, like, you narrowed in on, like, very particular neighborhoods and environments where children are growing up with a lot of the social fabric and civil society that kids in other neighborhoods who, and that one thing that's, it's hard to, for me, I mean, I grew up in Wisconsin, and I can sort of say, I know that these norms matter. I know that what people are watching on Murphy Brown matters, but it's hard to kind of translate it from the numbers to the reality. If you had to explain how that process works of people responding to cultural or pop cultural norms that elites set, but people with sort of fewer resources in terms of civil society, how do you explain that?
Well, I think it's sort of, you know, the issue here is that people kind of can take cues from what they see on, you know, TV or music videos or what they're listening to on their headset these days, that, you know, basically encourage them to live for the moment, you know, when it comes to things like sex or dating, that kind of minimize the importance of marriage and having kids in marriage. And then they do that, and then their peers do it, and there's a kind of, you know, a reinforcement effect. So, you know, whereas in a different era, you know, people were getting messages from their parents, from their teachers, from the pop culture that all kind of reinforced this idea of what we call the success sequence, you know, that you should get a high school degree, get a job, get married, then have kids. That was the way that most young adults, you know, did things. And the message was coming from basically every different part of the culture. Whereas today, you know, our schools don't talk about the importance of marriage by and large. The pop culture discounts it. You know, many other culture influencers are reluctant to kind of, you know, celebrate marriage. Some parents do, some parents don't. And so the kids just don't really have a message coming to them that tells them the truth, you know, and that is that if you put marriage before the baby carriage, you're much more likely to be flourishing financially. You're more likely to stay together as a couple with your kids. You have dad in the picture, you know, for the duration, to be happy, not to be lonely. So there's just to accumulate, you know, that's, I mean, you can just go on, obviously I could go on for hours, but the point simply is that we're just not telling our kids the truth, our young adults the truth about the way in which a kind of family-focused, marriage-minded way of life is much better for most adults and most kids, and especially for our communities as well. So that's our culture is just not great about conveying this truth, you know, in 2022.
All right, think about this. Many of us spend more time every day in our office chair than in our cars or in our beds. That's why it's so important to invest in the right chair so that you're spending those hours with the right level of support and comfort so that you can get the most productivity out of your day. When you think about it, we do spend so much time worrying about our mattresses and our cars and not our chairs. But X-Chair has made my time at my desk not only more productive, but it's honestly my favorite place to sit for any reason. So not only does X-Chair's patented dynamic variable lumbar or DVL offer the ultimate customized support, but my X-Chair can even give me a massage or heat up or cool down. And now, thanks to X-Chair's new FS360 armrests, I can even adjust my armrests to the perfect position. Now, all these unique X-Chair features help the hours at my desk fly by in complete comfort. And that's why I love my X-Chair. Go to xchairfederalist.com now. That's the letter X, chair, FEDERALIST.com, or call 1-844-4X-CHAIR for $100 off your order. X-Chair has a 30-day guarantee of complete comfort, and you can finance your purchase for as little as $30 a month. xchairfederalist.com. No, Brad's work is like a treasure trove of research on all of these questions. Sometimes I'll be wondering, I wonder if this correlates with that. And I Google it and I find out that Brad has already looked into it. But so let's talk about education, something that you've looked into, you know, for a long time as well. Father present families help close the gender gap in education. So this is another subhead from the research brief. And these numbers are incredible. And I think really, in a way, encouraging, but also discouraging. Encouraging in the sense that there's a solution right there, and discouraging in the sense that it seems so hard to grasp, I guess, for our culture. It seems like the numbers keep going in the wrong direction. But explain the connection between present fathers and success in education.
Yeah, so what we see really from an early age to college is that kids are growing up with their, you know, married parents, with, you know, biological dad in the picture, are much more likely to be flourishing in school and, you know, not getting in trouble with the principal, and then going on, you know, if college is part of their future, to attend and graduate from college. What we find here in this new report we've just released is that young men who are coming from homes with their biological fathers are more than twice as likely to graduate from college compared to their male peers who don't have a father in the home. This is a very large effect. And what's striking here, too, is that work done by David Autor, the MIT economist, indicates that the gender gap between male and female educational performance is much smaller for young men coming from, you know, intact two-parent families than it is for young men coming from non-intact families. And so the point here simply is that one reason so many of our boys are floundering in school and in the principal's office, not attending, not graduating from college, is that they don't have a father in the household, their own father in the household. They're not being raised in a stable married household. And that just puts them, you know, at disadvantage that is marked. And of course, we know that boys compared to girls are much more likely to act out and check out. And so girls today are much more likely to deal with anxiety and depression compared to boys, and girls from non-intact families without their fathers have more anxiety and depression. But when it comes to, like, you know, getting fights at school, having difficulty with the law, you know, becoming involved in some kind of criminal activity, again, it's boys the ones who are acting out in these kinds of very visible ways, either on the streets or in school. And that's why there's a kind of this gender gap is more sort of, you know, salient for boys from non-intact families than girls.
And the gender gap in and of itself, obviously, I mean, maybe a lot of people don't know about it. It's something that people have been writing about for years. And I think Christina Hoff Sommers, most notably back at the turn of the millennium, right. Looked as so prescient now when you go back. Again, things still seem to be trending in the wrong direction. But Brad, what do we know about, you just talked about this a little bit, but boys versus girls, and you mentioned the anxiety and depression, but even just in terms of academic performance, how those trends have developed in the last three decades?
Well, obviously, back in the day, in the 70s, you know, men were more likely to, you know, graduate from college, attend college, you know, get graduate's degree. But, you know, since then, we've seen women gaining ground and gaining ground and gaining ground. And when we're at kind of parity, I think, you know, everyone's kind of like fine with that. But we're now seeing, obviously, a pattern develop where women are excelling. Girls are excelling, you know, way beyond what, you know, what boys are. So when in our local Catholic school, we see that, you know, when it comes to, you know, the graduation ceremony, that, you know, the eighth graders, which is our terminal degree at our school, that the awards tend to go to girls, you know, more than boys. It's kind of a discrete example. But more generally, what we see is that college is now almost 60% female, 40% male. And we're on track to having basically two college graduates, you know, who are female for every one graduate who is male. And that's problematic because men and women who attend college are more likely to, you know, have decent incomes. And so what we're setting ourselves up for is a situation where, you know, we're going to have a lot of women who can't find men who make about as much as they do or more than they do. And it's still the case, even in 2022, that the average woman would like to marry a guy who is either her kind of financial equal or her financial better, you know, because they're just, there's this desire to have someone who's a decent breadwinner, you know, as your partner. And when you look at Pew data, for instance, you find that, you know, again, even today, single women place a much bigger premium on their partner's earning than men do. So we have this kind of disconnect unfolding where women still value men's financial abilities, their capacity to bring home the bacon, And yet our educational system is playing out in ways that make it difficult for a lot of guys to excel in school and in either technical, a trade school after that, or college. So that's the problem.
I'm glad you brought that up, because a lot of people might say, well, what's the big deal if men are going to college and, you know, the smaller numbers, because maybe they're going to trade school, maybe they're going to, you know, different places, they're going right into apprenticeships or whatever. But that's not the case, is it? We find idleness.
Yes. Some men, of course, are doing that. And of course, you know, especially today, obviously, you can make a ton of money as a plumber or electrician, or, you know, doing some kind of trade like that. There's no question. And we should do a better job, I think, in our high schools of celebrating and directing, you know, young adults, including young men, especially to those trades. But, you know, as I said before, too many of young men are not really doing much of anything. You know, in high school, they're playing a lot of video games and not really focusing on school or a trade. And then they kind of land in their 20s and they don't have much to show for it. And they're not working full time in a job that would have any kind of prospect to bring them to a middle-class income. So it's these men who are not really attractive as, you know, as husbands, and that's to their detriment and the detriment of the girls they're dating or with, and any kids that they have with them as well. So that's the problem we're talking about here in part.
Probably a little bit going into the gig economy too, which is something Tim Carney writes about in Alienated America, but I don't know if we have any information on that. I imagine that's part of the picture.
Yeah, no, there are plenty of young adults today, especially ones who are not college educated, who are, you know, driving for Uber or, you know, doing some other kind of, you know, DoorDash, you know, but it's episodic work, and it's, you know, it's work without much of a kind of real future. And, you know, there's really the problem too with it is there's no sense of community as well. You know, right. They're kind of like, you know, driving around their cars, and, you know, it's a, you know, at nighttime often when, you know, they could be home with, you know, again, family or friends or, you know, boyfriend, girlfriend. So it's just, I don't think it's a very, you know, it's not a great track for, you know, on a kind of permanent basis for them is what I would say.
Right. And dealing mostly with strangers they'll never see again, as opposed to coworkers, they're invested in those relationships.
Yeah, right. And as you know, if you've been to a restaurant, you can DoorDash, and often they'll just go pick up a little bag, get on the countertop, not talk to anyone. They'll drop off the bag in front of someone's door and not talk to the person. So it's just like this, again, it's sort of this asocial work that is, I think, from that perspective, also problematic.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And it's easy to see how tempting that would be to enter kind of the gig economy if you are an 18-year-old who just graduated high school with few prospects of college or jobs, and you want to make some money to get by and maybe have your own apartment. That would be very appealing right now, I imagine. And back to the question of fathers in particular, in education and in terms of educational success. This might sound like an obvious question to a lot of people who are listening, but Brad, if you can connect the dots for us, why is it helpful? Why do these numbers show what they show when it comes to academic success, especially for kids under the age of 18 and those who have a father in the home? Are there other variables? Is it just the variable of having somebody to push you to do your homework? Are there other things even beyond the obvious that might be at work here as well?
Yeah, so, you know, what David Autor has mentioned, the guy at MIT, the economist, just sort of having a father present in the household who kind of gets up in the morning, goes to work, comes home, you know, is sort of illustrating by his very life the importance of hard work, you know, is, I think, part of the story here. And so that young men, boys who are kind of growing up in a household where dad works, as opposed to boys who are growing up in a household where there is no dad, and there's no kind of, there's, you're not seeing kind of a day in and day out, you know, figure in your life who is working. Whereas, you know, in most single mother households, the girls are seeing mom again get up in the morning and go to work and come home, you know. And so one of the points here is that the challenge is that in single mother households, the girls still are seeing a connection between their, you know, their same-sex parent and work, whereas the boys are not seeing that. And then I think also too, the way in which, you know, men tend to be more authoritative parents than women, especially with teenagers. And so when it comes to kind of getting, you know, the teenage son off the, you know, the Xbox and onto the homework, that's helpful. When it comes to kind of making sure that the teenage son is sort of getting out you know, either for a job or to play basketball, again, rather than just playing video games. You know, these things all kind of add up. So the other thing that I would say, though, too, is that as I look at adolescents today and adults today, I see kind of two different routes of success, where young adults are kind of both boys and girls, young men, young women, are exercising agency is for young adults who are either academic or athletic. And so there are plenty of like really talented athletic students at UVA who are playing, you know, varsity sports of one sort or another. They've got very rigorous schedules where they're combining homework and practices and games. A lot of support that they get. And they've obviously come up through middle school and high school with parents, usually two parents who are helping guide them through sports, paying for, you know, travel, you know, tournaments and travel teams. So they benefit from having two parents who can afford financially and time-wise to, you know, be with them. And the same thing is true, of course, for the kids who are excelling academically as well. So I think having a father in the household sort of increases the likelihood that you can kind of either navigate the academic route or the athletic route, you know, in ways that tend to, you know, give those kids an advantage. And there are other kids who often from single, you know, mother households, lower income, and there's just not as much attention, not as much direction, not as much guidance, and not as much discipline. And that's just a recipe for trouble oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes or more often with, you know, these young men in our country.
Yeah, that's really good perspective. And what do we know? You just touched on this a bit, but what do we know about racial and socioeconomic breakdowns, not just in education, but about all of these numbers? Is there any sort of salient correlation there that people should be paying attention to? I know on the class level, this is always particularly interesting, but what does the picture look like?
Yeah, well, no, it's very clear in our new report that coming from a lower income household is an independent, you know, risk factor here for not graduating from college, for being idle as a young man, and for having trouble with the police and ending up incarcerated. That's also true for African-American young men as well. There's more risk. But what's striking in our new report is that for each of these outcomes we looked at, you know, from incarceration to college graduation to idleness, we found that the effects of family structure of being raised without a father were more important than the effects of race, you know. And so, you know, we talk a lot about the racial divide and racism in America, but I think on a lot of these outcomes, it's the family divide, you know, that is more consequential for our young men. That's what we find in this report. We also found, too, and this is a different study, we looked at school suspensions and found that, you know, when it came to suspensions, young white men from single-parent homes were more likely to get suspended than young men, African-American men from intact two-parent homes. So, again, it just kind of tells us that, you know, a lot of what we talk about in terms of race is really a family structure issue, and that when you look at African-American kids being raised in two-parent homes and white kids being raised in single-parent homes, for instance, those black kids are doing better. So it's worth, again, just keeping in mind that a lot of our issues of public concern, which tend to revolve around race, are missing this big family structure piece of the puzzle.
I think the reason I ended up in journalism is that I'm just so skeptical of absolutely everything. It's like a reflex. And so when the good folks over at MyPillow offered to send some towels my way, I was immediately skeptical. I thought, there's so much hype here. Can they live up to it? Nothing beats the feel of a luxurious towel when you step out of the shower. And I'm telling you, this is not scripted right here. These really work. They're very, very absorbent. I got them in a nice blue color, so you can also wrap yourself in nothing but the best with the MyPillow towel set. Other towels feel good but don't absorb, or they absorb but they're scratchy and just don't feel good. Every MyPillow towel is made from proprietary technology that makes them highly absorbent and soft to the touch, but without that lotiony feel. Plus, with a 60-day money-back guarantee, you can try them for yourself and return them if you're not fully satisfied. Made with cotton grown here in the U.S. and available in a variety of colors, each towel set comes with two bath towels, two hand towels, and a washcloth two-pack. So for a limited time, get the MyPillow six-piece towel set, regularly $109.99, for only $39.99 with promo code Federalist. Visit MyPillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. You'll also find deep discounts on all MyPillow products, including the MyPillow mattress topper, MyPillow Giza Dream Sheets, and so much more. Get your six-piece MyPillow towel set for only $39.99 today at MyPillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. Visit MyPillow.com/Federalist today. Well, actually, in terms of policy solutions, this is also well-timed, I think, around Father's Day with the release of a plan from Senator Romney's office. And it's kind of hard to describe because there's so many of these different ideas that have been floated, especially translated into policy. But what did you make of this one, Brad? Senator Romney had before rolled out a basically a cash benefit that was on a monthly basis, kind of no strings attached. Even Orrin Cass, who's been pretty supportive of this new proposal, wrote in the New York Times that the Romney idea, the original one, went too far. There was some, I think, criticism of it from experts who follow this. I wasn't a huge fan of it, but what do you think of the new proposal that was just published or was just released this week from Senator Romney?
Yeah, no, I am a fan of this newer proposal. What they have is basically a child allowance or family allowance that, you know, gives families a couple hundred dollars per child, but it only kind of rolls into its full level when you have at least $10,000 of income. So what that is doing is that it's, you know, preventing parents with no workers from getting money that, you know, they could use not to work. And I think also helping to prevent the possibility too that this would just be subsidizing you know, single mothers with, you know, no father in the picture, you know, from getting money from the government kind of in that way. So this, in a sense, promotes work. It doesn't penalize marriage. They're revamping the earned income tax credit to not penalize marriage as well. So I think this particular approach from Senator Romney, as well as two other senators, you know, is a good way to firm up the financial foundations of working and middle-class families, again, without penalizing marriage and without kind of rewarding people who've gotten no families with no worker in the labor force.
Yeah, and we've talked about, like, we're in the middle of a time period where it's uncertain whether a Supreme Court decision is going to come down on any day and overturn Roe v. Wade. We've talked about this a little bit before, too, but the importance of having the father in the home, as all your research bears out, is obviously whether or not the father is in the home affected by our culture and affected by our sort of sexual culture, our dating culture, all of that. When you look at policies that actually take into serious account the marriage penalty, like this one, maybe you could explain a little bit what the marriage penalty looks like and how easing it and reforming the way that our tax code penalizes marriage might encourage people to have fathers in the home, to be married, and not to continue sort of having sex out of wedlock, children out of wedlock, and then staying uncoupled, at least in terms of marriage.
Yeah, so I think one important point to make here is just that when we think about kids being born outside of marriage today, it used to be back in the 70s that was single moms, you know, having kids on their own without, you know, the father in the household oftentimes. But today it's overwhelmingly the case that the majority of kids being born outside of marriage are born to cohabiting couples who have some kind of relationship, you know. And yet what we see in a lot of our means tested programs like Medicaid, for instance, or the Earned Income Tax Credit, EITC, is that for many of these working class cohabiting couples, the kids, it makes more sense financially to have just the mom, you know, apply for a benefit, you know, like EITC or Medicaid to cover healthcare, and not to get married and report the dad's income because they would lose, you know, either part of the benefit or all the benefit. So I talked, for instance, to a couple here in Virginia recently. And, you know, beautiful two little daughters, you know, he's working at an IT company locally. She's a stay-at-home mother, traditional in many respects, but they were not married. I'm like, what's sort of going on here? And they said, well, we actually had sat down at the kitchen table and calculated that if we were to marry, we'd lose access to Medicaid in the state for the mom, the two daughters. So that was, that was the reason they weren't married, you know, at that point. So as we think about reforming our means-tested programs, I think we should have basically a threshold that's you know, about double for married families versus single parent families. And that would, you know, basically eliminate the marriage penalty in a lot of these programs. And we actually have, you know, addressed many of the marriage penalties for our income taxes, which hit families in the upper half of the income distribution, you know, much more than they do anyone else. But we have not in the Congress really tackled head on these marriage penalties that affect working class households especially. And of course, the irony here is that they're the ones who are the most likely to experience family instability. So that's a really a dereliction on the part of Congress that they haven't addressed these penalties.
Yeah, it is. It really is. Brad, it's always a privilege to talk to you about your work and to talk through some of these really difficult questions. So thank you so much for briefing us on the new report.
Emily, it's great to be with you today.
And happy Father's Day.
Thank you.
How many kids do you have?
We've got 9.
All right. So you get a lot of gifts on Father's Day. You get a lot of love.
We're busy. Yeah.
All right. Well, Brad Wilcox is the director of the National Marriage Project at the University of Virginia. He's a senior fellow at the Institute for Family Studies and a Deseret News contributor. You can read a lot of this research over at the Institute for Family Studies. And I believe this report will be published in the Daily Wire by the time you're all listening to this. So you can go take a look at that coverage as well. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at The Federalist. We'll be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.